control the investigation. So it's not just angry tweets by the president, it is actions behind the scenes, and specifically, among others, this order to McGahn to get rid of the special counsel, Mueller has to go, is the quote that's attributed to the president. Would this have been a slam dunk obstruction of justice case had McGahn himself not refused that order?
I don't know about a slam dunk, Steve, in part because the Justice Department guidance says you cannot charge a sitting president with a crime. Obstruction of justice is hard to prove. It requires a showing of intent. That said, there is evidence later on in this report that seems to suggest the president knew what he was doing when he was trying to get people to either refuse to cooperate with the special counsel investigation or get rid of the special counsel himself.
William Barr, the attorney general, in a press conference yesterday, gave what one reporter there described as a generous interpretation of the president's intent. And intent is vital here. Did you intend to obstruct justice? Barr says, well, he was frustrated. He was being attacked in the media by false reports, although we now know many of those reports were true. But in any case, Barr says the president was frustrated, and that seemed to be an explanation for his conduct, given that he was sure that he was innocent. What do other lawyers you've talked to say when they're told that the president attempted to obstruct the proceedings but had certain motives and didn't succeed?
Well, the notion that he didn't succeed is not entirely persuasive to some of the attorneys I've been talking with in the last 24 hours. In fact, they wonder why the special counsel didn't consider certain other kinds of charges, like an attempt to obstruct justice or aiding and abetting after the fact. It's not clear why authorities didn't analyze or at least show their work on that analysis in the report. And it's also hard to imagine, according to a lot of former prosecutors with whom I've spoken, that if this involved any other person, that it would not have resulted in some kind of criminal charge.
Carrie, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That's NPR's Carrie Johnson. Now, NPR political reporter Tim Mak is also covering this story. He's focused on the response in Congress. Hi there.
Hey.
What are you hearing?
Well, so congressional Republicans, they're echoing the president's line, no collusion, no obstruction, and they think that a lot of these investigations are baseless. Here's what Mitch McConnell, he's the Senate Majority Leader, here's what he told the press yesterday.
I trust Bill Barr. I think it's rather laughable to see them turn their guns on him. But that's all they're left with, frankly, is to go after him.
And when they talk about going after him, of course, that's the criticism for the way that William Barr has presented and interpreted this report and Barr's decision, not Mueller's decision, not to proceed with obstruction of justice charges.
Right. And you'll expect Bill Barr to be on the Hill being forced to explain his decision by Democrats who are very upset with what they feel is his behavior in not appropriately handling the rollout of the Mueller report.
Who will continue investigating and in what way?
Well, Democrats will continue to investigate not only on how this Mueller investigation took place, but also on other issues related to the president's finances and oversight of what they see as scandals throughout the Trump administration. They'll also be trying to get a fuller, less redacted version of the Mueller report we saw yesterday.
And I guess we should note that in some cases, the redactions in the Mueller report specifically said this item is redacted because there's an ongoing matter. Clearly, things are still being investigated behind the scenes by federal prosecutors of the FBI.
That's right. And it will also be of immense interest to Democrats who are trying to provide oversight of ongoing matters in the administration and things that happened before the Trump administration began.
Any appetite in the House to move for impeachment?
Not amongst Democratic leaders. I think that Democratic leaders in the House just don't want to move forward with something so divisive without some Republican buy-in.
Tim, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
That's NPR's Tim Mak.
Tomorrow, April 20th, is the 20-year anniversary of the Columbine High School shooting. Two shooters killed 12 students and one teacher before killing themselves. This mass shooting was one of the first to grab the nation's attention. And since then, Columbine alumni have shared lessons with the survivors of later mass shootings. Colorado Public Radio's Nathaniel Miner has more.
2 decades after the Columbine shooting, Heather Martin's description of the day is succinct. She was in choir class when the gunfire started. She and other students barricaded themselves inside, and hours later, a SWAT team found them. And that's about all she wants to say. But she will describe in detail how difficult it was to move on.
You know, I was 18, so what do? You move out. I moved out just into an apartment, went to a local community college, and struggled a lot, being in an environment where nobody knew what I had been through.
Martin dropped out of college. Her life spiraled.
Eventually, I developed an eating disorder, dabbled in some drugs. It was nothing serious, but it was definitely a red flag for me that something that I was traumatized.
Over the years, Martin pieced her life back together, but she still didn't like to talk about Columbine and would even go out of town every April around the anniversary. Finally, at the 10-year mark in 2009, Martin decided she'd avoided it long enough. She had to go back to the school.
I was really scared. I thought that I would be a wreck.
But then something unexpected happened when she met up with her high school friends.
We kind of just took a bunch of like funny photos in front of like the attendance office. Like, oh, look, this is where mom used to call in to ditch.
It was less of a memorial and more of a reunion. This visit, it was a turning point for Martin. Seeing all the people around her that day, it made her realize she wasn't alone. After that, Martin went back to college and got her teaching license. She and other Columbine survivors started the Rebels Project, a nonprofit named after their high school mascot. Martin didn't want survivors of other shootings to go through the same thing that they did. She wanted to help people like Sherry Lawson, a survivor of the Washington, D.C. Navy Yard shooting in 2013. Lawson was at work early on a Monday morning when the shooting started.
We ended up scaling the 8 to 10 foot brick wall that surrounds the Navy Yard and running up to safety because the shooter was still actively shooting behind us.
A dozen people were killed that day. And though Lawson made it home physically safe, it affected her emotionally. At her lowest, Lawson contemplated suicide.
And so one night at 3 a.m., I did this frantic Google search looking for some type of support system because I really just didn't feel supported.
She found the Rebels Project, Martin's group, and they started emailing each other. After 6 months, Lawson came to Colorado for a survivor's event.
I remember we went to this Thai restaurant, and then afterwards we sat in Heather's car and listened to Bruce Springsteen for like 3 hours and just talked.
Martin says they have a favorite song.
My City of Ruins. I have a hard time listening to it without choking up.
There's a blood red circle on the cold dark ground.
You know, it starts so kind of low and
somber.
Yeah, and you feel that, like you feel that emotion.
The church door's thrown open, I can hear the organ song.
It is usually the end of that song that gets me, and it's the rise up.
Come on, rise up. Come on, rise up.
And it reminds me that you've been through this thing, but life still goes on, and you can rise up, and it's not going to be the same, but good things can still happen, and definitely positive things have happened since.
After that trip, Lawson made a big decision. She left D.C. and moved to Colorado, where she felt like she had support.
And I legitimately have a family here. Like, I basically have made myself a member of Heather's family. And
you see our family Christmas photo?
These days, Martin and Lawson spend time traveling across the country together to communities affected by shootings. Martin says it can be draining, but it also forces her to think about her own recovery. And that's top of mind right now, especially with the 20th anniversary tomorrow.
I'm trekking through. I'm, you know, practicing a lot of self-care on my end, but this one's really heavy.
Because this one is a big round number, 20 years. Sherry Lawson says it's her turn to bear her friend Heather Martin's load. And she knows she'll need help herself in the fall when the date of the Navy Yard shooting comes around. They've promised to be there for each other. For NPR News, I'm Nathaniel Miner in Denver.
This is NPR News.
Time is 8:19. Thanks for tuning in to Morning Edition on WPR. I'm Peter Bryant in for Melissa Ingalls today. The report by Special Counsel Robert Mueller showed a number of examples of White House officials who publicly lied or were asked to by the president. That story coming up in 15 minutes, and we'll have headlines for you at 8:30.
Well, ahoy there, my public radio listening friends. I'm Chris Thiele, and I'd love it if you joined us this week for a variety show coming to you from the amazing Town Hall in New York City. Come spend time with our guests Josh Ritter, Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, and comedian Mike Lawrence. Ah, y'all, it's going to be a good one.
Saturday night at 5 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering kayaks, canoes, outdoor equipment, and education for anyone wanting to experience the natural beauty of Wisconsin. 220 West Broadway in Monona or rutabaga.com.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Softwave Fish Company. Sourced from around the globe, Softwave currently offers salmon, shrimp, Alaskan king crab legs, and more. The market is open Saturdays and the roadie from 10 until 2.
Mix of clouds and sunshine forecast across Wisconsin today. Breezy, especially by the afternoon, highs in the 50s and 60s. More of the same tomorrow, and then increasing clouds, a chance of showers, maybe a thunderstorm on Sunday.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Rice University, working to diagnose the economics of health. Through research and analysis, Rice is committed to helping improve health care and lower its cost. More at rice.edu/future. From Baird, for 100 years, Baird has partnered with individuals, businesses, institutions, and communities, working together toward their financial goals. More information is available at baird100.com. And from Home Advisor, committed to helping homeowners find the right pro for their home projects. Homeowners can get matched to local pros, read reviews, and check project cost guides at homeadvisor.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. What can we learn from the 2008 financial crisis that might apply next time? When the global financial system was melting down in 2008, Ben Bernanke was head of the Federal Reserve. Henry Paulson Jr. was Treasury Secretary. Tim Geithner was president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and later became Treasury Secretary as the crisis went on. Now the three men have written a book together about their experiences called Firefighting, the Financial Crisis and Its Lessons. They joined us to share those lessons. You write that many of the things we did appeared to reward the very financial industry that had dragged the world into the crisis in the first place. Chairman Bernanke, why was that?
Well, it's tough to prevent the financial system from collapsing without indirectly helping some people in the financial system. Our goal, of course, was to try to prevent the financial collapse from having broad, you know, implications for the U.S. economy, which ultimately, of course, it did.
Secretary Paulson?
In a system that is as complicated and intertwined as ours, you had to go to the source of the problem if you wanted to stop the bleeding. That's Wall Street. And it's just essential, you know, for to continue to create jobs, for people to get the loans they need to send their kids to college, to buy a car, to buy a home.
Timothy Geithner, should the administration have been more populist in its approach to this, lashed out at bankers a little more, prosecute people, do anything?
Yeah, we didn't. The three of us were not the arbiters of justice in the criminal side. We couldn't be. That wasn't our role. And the scandal was what was legal, not so much what was illegal. And even in the typical financial crisis, you know, the right thing to do is to protect the depositor, let the bank fail. The bankers lose their jobs. The firm doesn't exist to survive to another day. But in the extreme crisis where you're vulnerable to panic, you'll end up with mass unemployment and, you know, a decade of breadlines, soup kitchens across the country. And that's the dilemma, that what is necessary and essential and just and feels moral in a normal crisis is dangerous and unfair, because to sit back and let the crisis burn, the system collapse, will end up causing the most damage in the most unfair way on people completely innocent of most of the mistakes people made that helped cause the crisis.
All of the money put into the banks came back plus almost $50 billion. So the purpose was to avoid a a collapse of the financial system. That's why we did it. But the money came back with a profit, and the financial institutions ultimately paid for it. You're never going to get credit for avoiding a collapse precisely because we avoided a collapse of the economy, and people were rightfully unhappy about the huge burden that the crisis placed on Americans, many of whom, you know, were of modest means and least able to bear it.
So trillion-dollar deficits turned out not to be fatal in that situation. In fact, well over $1 trillion of deficits. Now we're in a situation where the deficit is climbing back up to $1 trillion in good times. Is it possible the deficits really don't matter at all?
If left unaddressed, then we're on a dangerous, unsustainable path. It doesn't mean there are things that we could borrow rationally for today that would have very strong, powerful economic returns for the country today. But there are limits to how much you can do that. And you can't safely meet all the broad challenges we face as a country by leaving the deficit path on the current, I would say, scary trajectory.
You say it's scary because why? Because if there was a recession and the government needed to borrow in order to boost the economy, the government would already be borrowing. There'd be nowhere to go. Is that it?
In the long run, you'll leave yourselves with much less room to protect people from in the next crisis or in the next downturn.
Do you believe the country is ready for the next financial crisis?
If a crisis does happen, many of the tools that we used and which other countries have used would just not be available. So we are better in the sense that a crisis might be less likely. But we are concerned, and this is a theme of our book, that if a crisis occurs, we just don't have the powerful tools that would end the crisis quickly and avoid the damage that otherwise might occur.
I think the central lesson of this crisis is that it's very dangerous to let your system outgrow the protections you need to put in place to limit risk and limit the risk of panics in the financial system. And that's a forever challenge. It never goes away. You can't sit there inert and let innovation erode those protections. They have to constantly evolve and adapt. And you need to make sure that they're conservative enough that they provide protection when things are really bad.
Secretary Paulson?
Yes, I agree with that. The other thing that I think is really important to keep in mind is the need for financial literacy. There are many well-educated people that don't really understand finance to the extent they should. Every American has got to be more vigilant and got to ask themselves, if I don't understand all the complicated language on this agreement, if I don't understand what's going on, I better work to understand that and make sure that I don't get myself overextended to the point where I can be seriously hurt by a reversal in markets or a downturn.
Chairman Bernanke, you get the last word here.
Financial systems are prone to breakdown, a panic or a run or a crash. You know, you can't leave it without some supervision. And smart supervision and the Federal Reserve and other agencies that oversee the financial system is really important to keep our system stable. And we want to avoid having the kind of events we saw a decade ago that endangered, again, not only the financial system, but the entire economy.
Ben S. Bernanke, Timothy F. Geithner, and Henry M. Paulson, Jr. are the authors, co-authors of Firefighting. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Noelle Sudano was a student at Columbine High School 20 years ago when two classmates killed 13 people. Now she's a school counselor on the lookout for troubled kids.
I see little things that can be concerning, like you're having a hard time controlling your anger. You have a lot of rage built up.
How mental health care in schools has changed since Columbine, plus reaction to the Mueller report. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered with Brady Carlson. Today and every weekday from 4 until 6:30.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
Time is 8:30. You're tuned to Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life coming up in about 15 minutes. And after that, a conversation with actress Elizabeth Moss. Headlines are next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The chairman of the House Judiciary Committee issued a subpoena this morning for special counsel Robert Mueller's full report and the underlying documents. NPR's Phil Ewing has more.
The chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler, says he's not satisfied with the material he's gotten from the Justice Department, the redacted version of special counsel Robert Mueller's report. He wants everything. He wants all the evidence generated by the special counsel's office. That's why he says he has no choice but to issue a subpoena compelling the Justice Department to give that material to him. This likely will set up a fight in court over what is in that material. The Attorney General, Bill Barr, says regulations prohibit him from revealing that to anyone, including members of Congress.
NPR's Phil Ewing. Yesterday, Barr issued a redacted version of Mueller's report. The UN Refugee Agency says a plane load of African refugees taking off from Tripoli in Libya landed in Niger early this morning. Lisa Schlein has more.
This is the first refugee flight out of Libya since fighting has escalated in Tripoli. The UN reports more than 200 people have been killed since clashes between rival factions broke out 2 weeks ago. The UN Refugee Agency warns some 3,000 refugees and migrants are trapped in detention centers near the fighting, putting their lives at risk.
Lisa Schlein reporting 163 refugees aboard that plane have been held in detention centers. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
And with Wisconsin Public Radio News, I'm Peter Bryant. At Madison's East High School last week, two male students allegedly raped a female student in a bathroom. They were arrested and charged with sexual assault. The district's head of security said kids will be kids, but later apologized. The incident and the district's response has angered some students. Members of the school's Gender Equity Club are calling on the district to hold the security head, Joe Ballas, accountable. They also want systemic change. Senior Anne Motovilov is one of those students.
If we just fire one person and don't implement any sort of standards for education, and we don't realize as a district we need to change the culture and not only the people who have responded to the situation, we're just going to have, like, you know, ballast after ballast after ballast after ballast.
In a statement, the district said there's no place for sexual assault or comments that minimize sexual assault in Madison schools. As ice thaws around the Great Lakes, technicians are preparing to redeploy buoys that gather a wealth of information for use in research, water safety efforts, and recreation. About a dozen research institutions operate buoys in the lakes. Many of them provide data to the nonprofit Great Lakes Observing System, which makes it available online. Ed Verham of the Ann Arbor-based engineering firm Limnotech says spring can be an especially hazardous season as conditions are often rough and change quickly. New U.S. Census Bureau figures show Dane County led Wisconsin in population growth in 2018. The county added more than 5,500 people, which accounts for a quarter of the state's growth last year. Overall, Wisconsin gained about 21,500 residents to remain the 20th most populous state. Milwaukee County, Wisconsin's most populated, lost about 2,400 residents. Mainly rural counties in the north saw a combined decline of about 19,000 residents. Weather forecast, a mix of clouds and sunshine today, breezy by the afternoon, highs in the 50s and 60s, mostly sunny and mild tomorrow, highs getting into the upper 60s, and then some clouds, chance of rain, even thunderstorms on Sunday, highs in the 70s in the south. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Total Wine & More, where in-store teams can recommend a bottle of wine, spirit, or beer for any occasion. Shoppers can explore over 8,000 wines, 2,500 beers, and 3,000 spirits. More at TotalWine.com. From Charles Schwab, Schwab believes a modern approach to wealth management starts with asking questions. Charles Schwab, own your tomorrow. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington.
And I'm David Green in Culver City, California, where we are on day one after the release of the Mueller report. And this morning, we are getting a move from Democrats that we expected. The chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Gerald Nadler, has subpoenaed the Justice Department for the full Mueller report. It is, of course, nearly 500 pages, although some material was redacted. And joining us to talk about this is NPR political reporter Tim Mak. Hey there, Tim.
Hey there.
So what precisely is in the subpoena? What's Nadler want here?
So Nadler wants the full Mueller report without redactions, but he also wants the work that special counsel Robert Mueller has done over the nearly the last 2 years. That includes grand jury testimony and other investigative material, and he wants it by May 1st.
That's soon. I mean, that's a quick timeline.
Well, he expects that the DOJ has this all available and ready to deliver. It's not quite clear, though, that the attorney general is willing to go down this route.
So you mentioned grand jury testimony. That is part of what was redacted from the report, right? I mean, we saw all these photos of all the pages of the report and how much of it was blacked out or not. Can you just remind us exactly what the attorney general redacted?
Right. So the Mueller report, there is, of course, the full version, and we saw a redacted version. And that redacted version contained four sets of redactions. The Justice Department basically blacked out material that they thought might reveal national security secrets, might reveal sources and methods in that affect national security. That's the first category. The second category is grand jury material. The third category would be things that might affect ongoing investigations. As we know, the Mueller team referred a number of other issues out for continued investigation and possibly prosecution. And the fourth category is things that might infringe on the privacy of peripheral third parties.
Wasn't there already a plan from Attorney General Barr to share some of the redacted materials with at least select members of Congress?
Yeah, there was a plan. The Justice Department has kind of put in place a way for key congressional leaders to access a version of the report with fewer redactions. But this would only apply to a select number of staff and key Hill leaders engaged in Justice Department oversight and intelligence and judiciary issues. But Jerry Nadler, who's the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, who issued this subpoena today, has said, look, this is not a situation where only a select number of lawmakers can review this material. This is a situation that has a lot of consequences for legislation and oversight and Congress's constitutional responsibilities. Everyone who's in Congress should be able to see all the material.
Okay, so he set this timeline of what, like less than 2 weeks or so. What exactly do you expect to happen next?
Well, this timeline is something that the Justice Department is going to have to consider. The Justice Department so far has said that it's not willing to go as far as the subpoena request, and that means we're likely to be in some sort of legal battle. In the interim, you know, there's going to be the time in which Attorney General Barr will need to get ready for his testimony before Congress in early May. We're going to see a lot of buildup around Robert Mueller's expected testimony, whenever that's scheduled. And there are going to be ongoing investigations by Congress into a number of issues, both related to the Mueller report and related to other things that are considered oversight over the Trump administration.
All right, Tim Mak, NPR political reporter. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
What can you do without your ID? Think about that, because around the world, 1 billion people do not have any form of official identification. That can prevent them from getting access to public services like healthcare or opening a bank account. Darian Woods from NPR's Planet Money podcast tells us about a contest to help change that.
Half of the 1 billion people without ID come from 5 countries: India, Nigeria, Pakistan, Ethiopia, and Bangladesh. And there are a few main reasons why people tend to not have ID. First is cost. Rolling out national ID is expensive. Next, legal barriers, like women barred from applying for ID themselves in countries like Pakistan. And then, trust. Some people don't want the government tracking them, often for good reason. But Vyjayanthi Desai of the World Bank says getting an ID can really improve someone's life if done right.
We need to build trust in the system. We don't want forms of ID that can be harmful.
Desai has set up this sort of Shark Tank-style pitch contest called Mission Billion.
How do you really leverage technology to solve some of these great problems like lack of identification, but while also mitigating against some of the potential risks like on privacy and data protection?
Contestants from all around the globe came to the World Bank headquarters in Washington, D.C. last week to pitch their ideas.
Digital IDs is an issue that has arrived. We're joined right now by Her Majesty Queen Maxima of the Netherlands.
In a packed room, over 100 people. Some of them wear headsets to listen in different languages.
Can we have a look at your ID first?
No.
Among the entries was a way of securely sharing your address online. There was a web-based platform that lets you take control over how your data is used. There was even a game called ID Land. One contestant, Toby Norman, he sits off to the side. He's getting ready to pitch his idea to solve the trust problem. Do you have a pre-pitch ritual?
I usually try and take four really, really deep breaths, big as I can go.
Norman runs a non-profit called Simprints. Simprints makes fingerprint scanners to register people for health services. But in Bangladesh, he hit a snag.
How do you actually get genuinely informed consent from someone who's had maybe 3 to 5 years of education in their entire lives?
He's made it into the final six for this World Bank contest.
Today. Welcome, Toby.
On the stage, he explains how he and his team came up with a tool to use audio recordings of trusted local leaders to ask for consent.
We've worked with human rights lawyers from the University of Oxford to design a layered consent approach.
The pitch is received well. Then, the other finalists. One idea was even developed by the inventor of the World Wide Web. And after all six pitches...
The winner is Simprints.
Norman and his team win. The prize is $50,000. But more importantly, it means attention. The governments of Rwanda and Uganda have reached out to Norman. That's on top of the 12 countries he and his team are already working with. Darian Woods, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Capital One, offering the Spark cash card for businesses. Committed to helping business owners turn purchases into meaningful investments that can help drive business forward. Capital One, what's in your wallet? More at CapitalOne.com.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition. Thanks for joining us. It's 8:42. I'm Peter Bryant in for Melissa Ingalls today. Coming up, Wisconsin Life in just a couple of minutes. Today, a story about a church organist, someone who's been doing the job for over three quarters of a century. And later this hour, an interview with actress Elizabeth Moss about her new movie, Her Smell. Stay with us. If you're 70 and a half years old or older and have a traditional IRA, here's some good news about how to take your required annual distribution tax-free. Support the lifelong learning you appreciate on WPR with an IRA charitable rollover. For more information, talk to your financial advisor or visit WPRlegacy.org. Your gift keeps Wisconsin Public Radio strong today and into the future. Thank you.
Support for WPR comes from The Bolt Company, providing professional construction services to customers in a variety of markets nationwide for more than 125 years. More about markets served, featured projects, and news is at bolt.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, that's what keeps you coming back. Visit jackanddrea.com for more information.
Here's some of the stories we're following this morning. Special Counsel Robert Mueller writes that President Trump's efforts to stop the Russia probe were mostly unsuccessful because people around him declined to carry out orders. Foxconn Technology Group says it remains committed to long-term job creation in Wisconsin. That coming a day after Governor Evers said it was unrealistic to expect the company to employ 13,000 people as promised. And Wisconsin's unemployment rate remains at 2.9% for the second month in a row. That's near the record low reached in April of last year. Mix of clouds and sunshine in the forecast today. Highs in the 50s and 60s. Breezy, too, especially this afternoon. Sunshine tomorrow. Highs again in the 50s and 60s. And then a chance of some rain, even thunderstorms, on Sunday.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Gunpowder and Sky, with the new movie Her Smell. Elizabeth Moss stars as a self-destructive punk rocker struggling with sobriety while trying to recapture the creative inspiration that led to her band's success. Now playing. And from Capterra, for helping people find the right software for their business. From applicant tracking to workflow software, visitors can access more than 800,000 software reviews and compare products. More at Capterra.com.
15 minutes before 9. This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's time for Wisconsin Life. Playing the organ in church is not a remarkable thing. It happens every Sunday. But doing the job for over three quarters of a century is a different thing. UW Eau Claire Professor of Journalism Jan Larson has the story.
For nearly eight decades, one Wisconsin farm girl has followed the music along the back roads of the bluffs high above the banks of the Mississippi. As the sun rises on Sunday morning, catching the mist off the alfalfa, a pickup truck crisscrosses the farmland on its way to morning services. Sunday church, weddings, funerals, private lessons, recitals, all have made her a fixture up and down the river towns of Highway 35, leading one local to remark, "Ain't but nobody what lives or dies but what don't know Luella Detling."
My name is Luella Detling. I was born September 29th in 1928. I have been playing piano for 81 years. My mother had one. I don't remember not having a piano and hearing her play. I grew up kind of around Stockholm, and then my parents bought a farm that was very close to Maiden Rock. I always lived on the farm. I remember her trying to start me playing when I was 6 years old. And I was a rather tomboy. I had a couple of brothers, so I was outside with them. I just really wasn't interested. I wanted to go outside and play. And then when I was seven, then she said, I decided that we're gonna try this again. She said, I just plain grabbed a hold. I wanted to play. Music has always been a joy. I would just sit right there by my mother and watch her fingers, just watch them and just listen. She was the organist and did all the playing in the church. But this morning, I remember getting ready and she said, I just don't feel good today. I don't think I can do this. She said, I think you can do that, so you go. I was 9 years old. That was going to be my first church service. And there were no bulletins in those days, and they didn't tell you what you were going to be playing. I got married, and we moved to a farm. And, you know, when you are trying to get started making a living, and you do not buy pianos. I didn't think much about it. But she did. She called me up one day and she said, there's a truck coming and I want you to stay right there now, she said, so don't go anywhere. I don't know whether I had any idea what she had done or not, but it didn't take long and she had bought a piano for me. So when she did that, she said, I was so afraid that if you didn't have a piano, you'd lose it. Think of the joy I've had. Tomorrow is Sunday, so I will be up about 5 o'clock. I'll go down to the two churches and take care of those on Sundays. as long as I'm able to do that. Only God knows when that will be, when I won't be doing it anymore. It's been a joy. It really has. It's been a good part of life.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, a sacred music concert with John Innes, pianist for Billy Graham, and Dr. E.H. Singley from Moody Bible College will take place at Calvary Memorial Church in Racine at 6 p.m. on Sunday, April 28th. An offering will be taken.
Peer events are great for adults and for kids, too. Find out where and when Workplay Earth Days are happening in your area at wpr.org/events.
Good morning. It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. Good to have you with us this Friday on WPR. In sports, the LA Dodgers beat the Milwaukee Brewers 3-1 last night, extending their winning streak to 5 games. Stephanie Elkins joins us in about 15 minutes with classical music, including some music for Passover, that and more music for you from 9 until 3 o'clock today. News headlines as well on the hour, news from NPR and WPR at 9.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A new movie features an actress better known for TV. Fans of Mad Men and The Handmaid's Tale will know Elizabeth Moss. In Mad Men, she played Peggy Olson, a determined copywriter at a male-dominated advertising firm.
I don't know if you're aware, but I brought in the Popsicle account today on my own.
In her new film, Moss plays a very different kind of role.
So enough with this jibber-jabber, and let's rock! And that sums it up in one big lump.
This movie is called Her Smell. It was written and directed by Alex Ross Perry. We should mention the studio Gunpowder and Sky is among NPR's financial supporters. Now, the film imagines the chaotic life of a drug-addled musician. Moss plays Becky Something, the lead singer of a fictitious all-female punk band in the 90s. She joined Rachel Martin to talk about the part.
Becky Something is a toxic personality, sort of dealing with a lot of her own issues and demons. But I think we've all kind of experienced that kind of person who we just, you know, somehow you can't get away from them. They're very interesting, but they're not good for you.
Yeah. There is a manic intensity to, I mean, everything she does. And the film does such a good job of creating that frenzy from the very beginning. I mean, it's just like nonstop, just crazy.
I gotta get out of here. I gotta go to Becky's room. Stinks of yelled at the bitch you would do. Inhibitor, 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 that's all. Fuck! Oh,
I mean, was that hard? Where did that come from?
Well, it was on the page.
It was on the page. So that's not ad-libbing.
Oh, no, 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 no. There's pretty much zero improv or ad-lib. And that's kind of one of the things that Alex did was he wrote this character who had these long monologues, who spoke in this stream of consciousness, but it was incredibly specific. It was the hardest dialogue I've ever had to learn because if you, even though it sounds like rambling, even though it sounds like it doesn't make sense, if you change a word or if you flip two sentences, it actually really doesn't make sense. So it really had to be pretty much spot on.
Hibbida hibbida was on the page.
100%. I mean, I think he threw every pop culture reference previous to the early 90s that he could throw in there. Most of which I didn't know.
I was just
going to
ask you, is that your time and was this your music?
No, I mean, I was born in 82, so I sort of missed this. I missed the 90s music.
You had music growing up, right? Your parents were musicians?
Yeah, but much more in jazz and blues. I learned the piano a little bit when I was little because it was just sort of like required. But no, because I was a dancer and an actor, I didn't really have time to also learn an instrument.
Did you then need to work on playing the piano and just the musicality of the character singing?
Yeah.
Guitar.
Yeah. I mean, I learned the guitar. I practiced for about 4 or 5 months, I guess. I was not going to become a guitarist, but I just needed to learn how to look like I was playing these songs. The piano was the one I did actually have to learn because that was one take live from beginning to end. But it was a very, very simple version of Bryan Adams' Heaven.
Oh, thinking about all our younger years, there was only you and me. We were young and wild and free.
It's a great scene. You're playing a song for your daughter.
Yeah, and she sort of abandoned her daughter. She is an alcoholic and a drug addict and recovering and trying to repair her relationship.
It's the most beautiful, no offense to Bryan Adams, but it's a great version of that song.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I like to think it's better. I think Bryan Adams is not going to be threatened by my performance.
Baby, you're all that I want when you're lying here in my arms. Finding it hard to believe we're in heaven.
There's this energy between you and the young actor who's playing your daughter. And I did in that moment think as I was watching it, how do you act that? How do you act through playing the piano when it's not natural to you?
Well, what was interesting about that scene is just that I was sort of saved by where Becky is in the film because I think she is really nervous. And I, as an actor, was really nervous to play the song because it's not my forte. And so it really didn't hurt that I was a little bit nervous myself.
Right. It actually played into the fact that they don't really know each other, these two people.
Exactly.
What came out of that in terms of your own ambition? I mean, this was you. This was Elizabeth Moss. I mean, it was a beautiful script. But the number of minutes where it's just you on screen, either those monologues or your face, did you learn anything about your craft from this particular project?
I didn't think about it that much. I just did it and just kind of went as big as I could and threw it all at the wall, knowing that Alex and I knew that the only mistake we could make was not going far enough. And so we both just went for it.
And you know what? That's why I'm leaving, because when I needed it, nobody ever put a hand on my back and told me it was going to be all right.
Did he ever have to pull you back? I mean, did it ever feel too far? Or you're like, nope,
no.
That's where it should be.
So we started with Act One, and I remember basically him just being like, faster, faster, faster. And I was like, okay. And we got there. And by the time we got to like Act Three, where she's just truly lost her mind and is high on so many things, I had turned it up to 11 and then realized I had to go even higher.
The little thing!
What was it like for your co-stars? I mean, just to be in your energy.
I felt bad for some of the people that I didn't know as well. I'm not really that good at being social on set. I'm not somebody who, like, sits around and chats because I just, it's too tiring for me and I need to kind of conserve my energy. So I only felt bad for people that I didn't really know as well. I remember Amber Heard came in and did a couple days, and I apologized to her at one point. I was like, I'm really sorry. Like, I just met you, and I'm not this person. But everybody else was incredibly supportive, particularly Aggie and Gail, my bandmates. Yeah. We had a real nice unit from the very beginning.
And it's clear. I mean, it's a subplot, but the nature of female friendship, too, is really strong in the film.
Yeah, thank you. I think so. And the forgiveness that's possible.
Yeah.
And also the generosity in sometimes saying, that's it, we're done.
Yeah.
You know, especially with an addict, there's a point that you have to walk away. And both of those characters reach that point.
Elizabeth Moss, her new film is called Her Smell. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green.
I'm Peter Bryant in for Melissa Ingalls today. Thanks for joining us for Morning Edition. Tune in every weekday and join us on the weekends, too, for Weekend Edition starting at 7 on Saturdays and Sunday. Headlines next, followed by classical music.
Support for WPR comes from Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona, Minnesota, now exhibiting Maria Svarbova Swimming Pool, Slovakian socialist-era swimming pools in a retro and futuristic style. MMAM.
Support for WGTD comes from Classic Violins, offering a summer Suzuki camp, offered by master teacher and certified Suzuki trainer Donna Curry, starting in June. Call 577-5488 for details. Classic Violins, where quality meets tradition.
.com.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.